Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Tom Verton, Chief Operating Officer of Silicon Valley Bank and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Willie Brown, who is here to give his annual talk on the state of national and regional politics. Two-term mayor of San Francisco, legendary speaker of the California State Assembly, and widely regarded as one of the most influential African-American politicians of the 20th century, Willie L. Brown, Jr. has been at the center of California politics, government, and civic life for over four decades. Mr. Brown was born in Texas, moved to San Francisco, and graduated from San Francisco State in 1955 with a degree in political science. Mr. Brown earned a law degree from University of California Hastings College of Law in 1958. He spent some years in private practice before winning election to the California Assembly. Mr. Brown became the Assembly Speaker in 1980. He was known for his ability to manage people and maintain party discipline. From civil rights to education reform, tax policy, health care, domestic partnerships, and affirmative action, he's left his mark on every aspect of politics and public policy in the state. According to the New York Times, Mr. Brown became one of the country's most powerful state legislators. Mr. Brown became mayor of San Francisco in 1996 after nearly 30 years in the Assembly, 15 of those as Assembly Speaker. As mayor, he accomplished much, including rebuilding the transit system, building affordable housing, creating a model juvenile justice system, and positioning the city as a center for the advancement of biotechnology in California. The San Francisco Chronicle called Mayor Brown one of San Francisco's most notable mayors. Today, he heads the Willie L. Brown Jr. Institute on Politics and Public Service, where this acknowledged master of the political game shares his knowledge and skills with a new generation of California leaders. Please join me in welcoming Willie Brown.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction, and I must say that you're the first banker that I've seen in a long time. Most people don't admit that they're in the banking business these days for whatever reason, but I'm proud of you. Thank you very much for your very kind introduction. Let me join in extending a welcome to each and every one of you. It was Joe Fink, the man who heads the college or the university that I serve on the Board of Trustees of Dominican University, that I suppose it was 5 or 6 years ago that he was the head of the Commonwealth Club, occupying the same position you now have, and he leaned on me to come visit with the Commonwealth Club in May of that particular year to discuss the business of the actions occurring at the national level, at the state level, and at the city level, and we enjoyed ourselves on that occasion, and it's now grown to where every chair in the House appears to be filled. Who'd they tell you was speaking tonight? Because you were not here last year and the year before that and the year before that, so it must be misleading you, and I hope that even if you are misled, you'll be interested in coming back. The Commonwealth Club obviously has a collection of occasions of various persons extending words of wisdom, or in some cases, just words. But it's literally worth coming and participating in the process. I understand that there will be an opportunity for question and answers. Some of you obviously have shown up already with your questions, and you haven't even heard from me yet. I can assure you I will not be covering anything that you've already asked about because I got a chance to kind of glance over there. So the subject matter of your questions, you're going to have to do it again, and you're going to have to do it while I'm in the classroom with you. None of this stuff of coming in pre-prepared. This is an interesting time period for those of us who are in the world of politics. And by the way, as an aside, there's been some changes in my life since I last appeared at the Commonwealth Club. I now do a column every Sunday in the San Francisco Chronicle. And I must tell you that I'm really enjoying doing the column in the Chronicle. My friend Herb Cain had told me that there's nothing that is more enjoyable than being able to write about without necessarily knowing the facts. I'm obviously very good at that. I spent 40 years at doing things without necessarily knowing the facts. And so I'm having just a great time with the Chronicle article. And I must tell you that I'm very interested in anything you might have to say or you think I should write about or any subjects you think I missed. I'm very sensitive to criticism, so don't do that. But suggestions or in doing the column, by the way, it's amazing how many people apparently read the column, because I walk the streets a lot here in San Francisco. I always have been kind of a street walker, so to speak. And in the process, I had to tell you, these people read the column. Homeless people read the column. And they really correct me. That's wrong. That's not the way it was. You're in the wrong part of town when you describe what you described. And I, of course, listen very closely and go right on, because I know what I'm talking about. No, he doesn't, supposedly. And the wonderment, though, of the people who take time to actually communicate through the emails and through the text messages and through the elaborate hope to be printed on the editorial page. I am not in charge of what they print on the editorial page. Somebody, though, that has an issue with me on the Chronicle must be, because I haven't seen one complimentary editorial. They select all the crazy ones, and as I call them, and they write about it and say, I don't know what I'm talking about, etc. But it's enjoyable, frankly. It's clearly enjoyable. So feel free to please share with me things you think I need to cover, incidents that you observed and that you think other people would like to know about. It's kind of a nosy column. It's kind of a column that makes available to you all of what happens in San Francisco that you've not been a part of. That's what I am attempting to do with the column. Bring us all into the same room on every issue, on every bar that I go to, every restaurant, every movie that I see, every person that I see poorly dressed. All of that is covered in the column. So feel free to share. Tonight, however, for those of us in the world of politics, these are just incredible, incredible times, because we all witnessed a marvelous transformation in the political landscape as a result of the election of Barack Obama as the president of these United States. It was a campaign that was conducted unlike any previous campaign in the history of this country. I have raised a lot of money in working for candidates and running candidates for office and in running myself. At one time, I had the record of raising money. But Mr. Obama raised more money in one campaign than I raised in the entire 40-year history that I raised money for campaigns. He raised over $700 million in his efforts to become the president of these United States. And that is just one example of the dramatic way in which he changed the landscape, because in that $700 million, there were millions of people who gave him very small amounts of money, investing in what they thought would be a dramatic change in the nature of America, and feeling, they really felt like they had a piece of the pie, so to speak. They had a bit of the ownership by virtue of what they gave him. I said in my column that one of the people who worked in the building where I live said to me on the day or so after he had been elected how proud she was of the fact that he had been elected. It's a person who originated in the Philippines. And she talked about how she and her family, over the last 12 or 14 months, every month had sent Barack Obama, when solicited, 25, 50. Now, I know this woman can't afford that, but she apparently represented the new American, the new person participating in the political process. Mr. Obama understood that, and Mr. Obama's conduct has, in fact, reflected the change that has taken place, where they're not seeking necessarily the advice of the Willie Browns of the world or the people who come from that generation. They don't even know where Jurassic Park is, let alone seeking any advice from anybody who's been to Jurassic Park in the world of politics. They really are literally extending the opportunity by virtue of the velocity of his movements on almost every subject matter of which you can think of. Some people say he appears to be continuously campaigning. Well, I maintain that no, he is not continuously campaigning. What he is doing, though, is he is inviting full participation by all of us, and the only way to do that, obviously, is to make sure that each of us are clued in to his everyday movements. Each of us are participants in the deliberations that are going on with reference to the various issues that he evidences concerned about or he deems appropriate to be responsive to. He's also done what no other president has attempted to do, and that is move very quickly to establish an international presence of the president himself. He didn't send Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice. He has gone himself to the various capitals in Europe. He has gone himself to other places like Canada, Mexico, and South America to meet with various leaders. He's even gone to parts of the Middle East to meet with some of those respective leaders. He's actually taken those extraordinary steps to say, I am not sending a surrogate. I represent the most powerful country on earth. I represent a group of people who really are interested in the democratic process, and we demonstrate that by our openness in dialogue with those who may have some disagreements with us. And he's doing that in very dramatic fashion. Likewise, he's also on the domestic front, being unusually aggressive. When elected, he inherited the absolute worst economy that I think any one of us have ever experienced. I don't see anybody old enough to have been here in 1934 for experience purposes, or 1930 for experience purposes, or 1928 for experience purposes, personally, because you'd been too young at that time. But there is no way there's anything that has occurred since that time period till this present day that rivals the experience we're going through as it relates to this economy. Mr. Obama inherited that situation. And Mr. Obama has proceeded boldly to begin to address that issue and to address it with some imagination, to address it with systems that have never been tried. And I must tell you that in some cases I've been critical of him in my column for some of the things that he has attempted to try. I may very well on this coming Sunday, Mr. Banker, be critical of him about the so-called bank stress test. I don't know how this is a situation which has never occurred before and hopefully will not occur again, and people in his administration have come up with proposals to say that they will take a look at your bank, evaluate whether or not the factors in how you operate your bank, how your bank is capitalized, how your bank secured deposits, etc., whether or not that meets some imaginary tests to determine as best you can that if 3 years out and the world has gone totally upside down, will you be capable of giving your depositors back their money? Well, I say that there's no precedent for determining whether or not there's any accuracy in this so-called stress test. And the people who came forward with the idea of the stress test, in my opinion, do not represent a good set of options by their previous performance on imposing upon us the so-called stress test. For an example, I have said to the president and to his operation when asked, I don't know how Tim Geithner has a job. How do you head the Feds in New York? You headed the Federal Reserve in New York. You were there when Wall Street was at its worst in terms of what it was doing, that's reflecting itself in the bad things that are being reported about the financial institution of this country. He had direct supervision over that collection. How can he now move to the spot of Treasury and then proceed to develop any credibility with me on whether or not he can effectively address the issue in such a way that the situation will alter itself? The whole business of deregulating what banks can or cannot do, the whole business of taking banks from being institutions that we had great confidence in and turning them into what's called investment banks, which most of us know nothing about and have no sense in dealing with and shouldn't be dealing with anyway, and giving each of them the same opportunity, resulting in this all bizarre concept of over-leveraging every asset. These are the people who were supervising all of that, should have been supervising, and suddenly they're in Washington now orchestrating the so-called bailout. So I have some serious questions and reservations, and many other people in this country, I think, would have the same. Again, this is the kind of presidency, though, that can stand those direct criticisms, that welcomes the opportunity for dialogue on those issues. And I just hope a different collection of economists who clearly are in America, preferably those who were the whistleblowers, those who raised questions about Madoff's performance for a multiplicity of years, those are the kind of people I think ought to be in dialogue with the people who were part of the process that led us to where we are, so that there can develop some confidence in changing the course of action as it relates to the financial institutions of this country. There are also other issues on the domestic side that he is attempting to address. When he looked at the health care delivery system, when he said in the campaigns against Hillary Clinton and John Edwards in particular, he took, I think, the most moderate position on the health care delivery system. So far, there's been very little evidence that that is translating into any real action on the delivery system that clearly needs to be addressed. I think he needs to become imaginative. And on this day, I'm going to give him an idea about that imagination. I think one of the real tragic situations in this country is our inattention to the issue of obesity. I would guess that if we would really, from the president on down, begin to address the obesity issue, you could probably cut the cost of health care in this nation by addressing the obesity issue. You could cut the cost of health care 10 to 15% over a measured period of time just by somehow controlling how we eat, what we eat, how much exercise we take, all of the things that are related to obesity. Because I would guess that every time there's any medical problem associated with anyone, I suspect that the issue of weight has something to do with whether or not the medical delivery system can effectively address the issue. I should also think that there needs to be some serious attention in the medical delivery system. If you're talking about a real universal health care operation, you've got to talk about what does that mean in terms of care. Do we provide everybody in this country with the same coverage that Mr. Obama has and his family has as the president? I suspect not. I suspect that that cannot be afforded. And no politician wishes to begin to talk about, do we necessarily need to discuss the rationing of health care? Do we need to address what is appropriate in the insurance delivery system for us to cover, and how should we cover it? The whole question of whether or not there can be a difference in Joe Biden, and I think probably John Kerry said it best, the whole question of whether or not as a difference in the premiums for females versus males. Can we not begin to effectively address those issues within the context of the whole question of affordability? That dialogue needs to take place. And it needs to take place, incidentally, not in the close operation with a very few people. At the table needs to be the people who are going to pay for it, i.e. the employers, the people who are going to share in that cost from the employees, the people who are going to provide the services, i.e. the medical providers, and the people who are going to sell the insurance where it is appropriate to purchase insurance for that purpose needs to be at that desk. And then finally, the patient themselves, where they're in, if they're not in any of the previous categories, needs to be involved. So far, Mr. Obama has not exactly done that the way he is doing some of the other things. Yes, he said, I will address the issue of war in Iraq, and he has done so. He's made it very clear that the Hillary Clinton-type solution of saying we're out of there by a certain measured period of time, we will not be stupid on our way out the door, we will make sure that there is a level of security by the people whom we're leaving behind to run their own country, and we will remove combat troops, but we could very well be stuck with other kinds of troops there in perpetuity. He has done that. He's also said, I will do something about the war in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. He's changed the number of people who will be a part of the troop contingent. He has increased it dramatically. And he's also said on the foreign policy question, I will address the issue of what happens between this country and Cuba. And he has done so by saying, those of you who have relatives in Cuba, you can send them some money. There's no longer any limit on what you can send them in that regard. And if you are truly Cuban and your relatives are there, you can actually go to visit your relatives. He has not lifted the embargo yet, but he's moving in the direction of where that embargo will, in fact, be lifted. So he's done really dramatic kinds of things to address the issue of how we deal with international questions, and he's done so from the perspective of some of the things that he said. And each step, he is continuously involving each one of us. He's continuously communicating. There has not been a president like this in a very long time. George Bush was a secret almost to most of us for a period extending beyond when we wanted him there. Nevertheless, it's clear that this man is offering the opportunity for us to see him close up and personal on a daily basis, and it is just mind-boggling how he can keep that pace up, how he can, in fact, cover so many subject matters and so dramatically, and how he can reference them so freely and so easily. He's also enjoying a marvelous, warm, continuous relationship with the press. Last year, when I was here, I talked about how Hillary Clinton had developed an animosity with the press and how Obama had developed a love relationship that was the envy of every other politician. Well, I got to tell you, to this date, he is enjoying that love relationship in high order. His numbers have improved dramatically. There has been almost no linking him to any of the errors or the hiccups that he should be suffering. Even when Bill Richardson had to be yanked as a prospective person to head the Commerce Department, the public still has not attached that to Mr. Obama as a failure to have properly vetted Mr. Richardson before he grabbed him and before he nominated him. Likewise, with reference to Tom Daschle, who had some issues with reference to reporting or his income and the benefits that he was receiving from doing whatever he was doing in Washington. When he was nominated to be the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, it became painfully clear very quickly that he could not get the approval unless it was a bruising, vicious fight. Mr. Obama has not suffered one ounce of negative associated with Tom Daschle's early exit. And there have been a whole series of other people similarly situated. He's got Larry Sumner working in the White House on the economic advisory issues, and the people that he is attempting to deal with, Mr. Sumner is attempting to deal with, it appears as if he had a $5 million relationship with these people over the last several years. That has not in any way affected Mr. Obama from a press standpoint. And the same goes from other people who didn't pay their taxes. Tom Geithner didn't pay his taxes. He is the guy who was the Treasury Secretary. That hasn't touched Mr. Obama in any fashion. It's just incredible how Mr. Obama is being given the opportunity to succeed. He is being urged to succeed, and that is a wonderful space and place in which to be if you are a politician. Most politicians don't get that opportunity. My guess is that we are all so eager for this administration to succeed. We are all so eager to get behind us the previous administration and all of the bad things that occurred to this nation and this world as a result of that administration, or is attributable to that administration. There is clearly optimism about Mr. Obama. And then finally, of course, Mr. Obama's incredible focused attention on what happens to all of the ills associated with the justice system when it deals with issues involving terror. He had said early on that he would do something about that horrible prison base in Cuba. And he is doing exactly what he said about that horrible base in Cuba. He said he would raise the issue of torture, and he would not allow America to engage in torture. It would not allow America to engage in preemptive strikes, so to speak, in an effort to secure our borders. He has taken all the steps in all of the directions, and I would guess that that, more than anything else, contributes to the increased numbers for the Obama administration. I could obviously go on for another 20 minutes about the Obama administration, if not even more. But suffice it to say, it is a action operation. It is a study that any of us who are observers of the political scene are just absolutely awed by, because it represents someone trying to master the totality of all of the issues and to be able to personally articulate them in terms and on levels that can be understood by everybody that voted for him in the last election cycle. It is just fabulous. In the process, he has literally destroyed the opportunity for the Republican Party to effectively respond. It is the most amazing thing when you find yourself with Rush Limbaugh being the spokesperson for your party. You know you're in trouble because talk show hosts should probably never be the spokesperson for anybody's party. That's not their role. Can you imagine Ron Owens being the spokesperson for the Democratic Party, whatever party he chooses? I don't think you'd think that. But that's where the Republicans are. They really don't have an organized operation. I watched on one of the talk shows a couple of nights ago when the question was, why is it that the Republicans haven't said anything about health care? The Republican who was on there said, because we don't really have anything yet to say about health care. But it's the same thing with reference to almost every other issue. And many times when they do the so-called equal time response, they are a disaster. That governor of Louisiana, I suspect that they are sorry they ever overexposed him. Just to say hello was a disaster on his part. And the same goes for a series of other people. They don't have anybody yet. My guess is that they're going to have to reach back and recycle Newt Gingrich, because there isn't anybody else that is fleet of foot and of mind and understand the nature of communications that will allow them to get there. And it's all because Mr. Obama has so raised the bar and has so changed the nature of how politicians act and interact with the constituency that he's made it impossible for the old ways to be a part of anybody's system that would be attractive. State of California, in a disaster mode, as of the 19th of May, if at 8 p.m. in the evening, those measures that are on the ballot have all gone down to defeat, and I do believe that it is predictable that they will go down to defeat. As a matter of fact, unless somehow that they get on the backs of Mind That Bird, that Kentucky Derby winner, they clearly are not going anyplace in the Preakness nor in the Belmont as it relates to a positive vote among the people of this state. If the people of this state do not cast their votes for those measures, I, for the life of me, cannot envision how Governor Schwarzenegger and the two houses of the legislature are going to be able to deal with the disaster that will be facing us. You would think that Chrysler, who is in real trouble and is on bankruptcy, you'd think the city of Vallejo, which is equally as challenged. The state of California, you're going to make each one of those look like very simple and easy, man, to handle if we do not succeed on May 19th in the election. I just don't have an answer. I'm willing, obviously, to be a part of any dialogue they may wish to have, but I would tell you that they're in bad shape. Now, you ask, give us your observations as to why they're in such bad shape. Well, they're in such bad shape in part because, obviously, the nation is in bad shape with the economy being what it is. But the state of California has been challenged long before, on the money side, long before the issue of the economy, which has affected all of us in one fashion or another, affected the state of California. State of California commenced to have a problem. You recall, Gray Davis was recalled because he was looking at a $7 or $8 billion deficit, and Mr. Schwarzenegger running in the recall election made hay of it. Many of our Republican colleagues likewise made hay of it. And as soon as Mr. Schwarzenegger got elected, it became clear to Mr. Schwarzenegger that it's not an easy task to correct that. Simultaneously, it got exacerbated because one of the things that was an issue in that election was the so-called car tax. Nobody wanted to pay the car tax. Well, if you don't pay the car tax and you eliminate the car tax, you better eliminate what the car tax was financing, or you better find something to substitute for what the car tax was financing. That's not what we did, and that's just one example of what has gotten us in trouble. We have been about the business of not properly financing the kinds of programs that we put in place, demanded by the people, wanted by the people, and appreciated by the people. We politicians have never had the courage to require those programs to be, in fact, funded. We've done what I was kind of famous for doing, and that was overestimating income and underestimating expenditures on a regular basis and leaving a deficit situation as a result thereof. The state of California has been practicing that process glaringly, and as a result of that, cumulative over the years, we've come to the tragic situation where the governor now says we're looking at something in excess of $40 billion and potential deficit if the measures that are on the ballot do not pass. I would guess that the only answer to that, since there are no Republicans who will vote for any increase in revenues, will obviously be some dramatic, horrible reductions in the delivery system. That process may visit itself upon us, not unlike what's happening with Chrysler, and that corrective course of action may be painful and inconvenient for a measured period of time, but coming out of that chaos, I think, will come a solid operation that will spend what we raise, will spend what we produce, and not a penny more. And in that process, I would think that we will begin to run the state with the same kind of courage from leadership standpoint of which we did a few years ago when George Duke Majan was there, when Pete Wilson was there, when I served in the halls of the legislature. Term limits has robbed us of much of the talent that was originally reposed in the House. People who had a sufficient amount of confidence that they could go back to their voters and say, these are the reasons why we are increasing the revenues and the way in which we're doing it. Whether it was Reagan who signed a tax increase bill, whether it was Duke Majan who signed a tax, or Wilson who signed a tax increase bill, all of those people who voted to give them that opportunity, and it would takes two-thirds to do that, had the confidence that they were speaking on behalf of a group of people who understood why they were doing what they were doing, and therefore political punishment did not visit itself upon them in that delivery system. We don't have that anymore, in part because of term limits, and so the state of California is in a disastrous Down syndrome operation that I'm not sure when bottom will be reached. And then finally, in the delivery system, San Francisco, my favorite place. We are challenged, and I'm amused, frankly, on a daily basis at watching what is occurring out at City Hall. There is still a dramatic separation of government in San Francisco between the administration and the supervisors. It occurred, that separation started during my term. It has reached a crescendo since I left. The left, led by people like Aaron Peskin, who isn't even in government anymore, but on the outside as chair of the County Central Committee, they are still creating nightmares for our good friend and our own mayor, young Mr. Newsom. And in the process of that, it's creating a great challenge that I'm not sure how they are going to get out of the situation in which they're facing, although they are taking some dramatic steps. The cuts that have been engaged in and the movement in San Francisco, dramatically different from what has occurred in the state of California, may in fact lead to a solution to the budget problems in this city. I read, I think just yesterday, that finally somebody has decided to address the issue of offline financing. What is offline financing? It means that I run the municipal transportation system and I carry cost associated with other agencies of government on the basis that those agencies of government are providing me with assistance. Of course, they're not providing me with any assistance that's measurable, but nevertheless, in order to get a source of financing to a source where it's needed, we engage in that kind of movement of resources. And of course, this Board of Supervisors are raising questions about it. No one has yet taken a hard line that you can't do it, because it will immediately mean certain things will have to cease to exist in this city because of the absence of funding. If you really take the hard line that you can't allow, let's say, the 311 operation to charge Muni for what they say most of the calls are, they said that in the 311 that's been established, 87% of the calls are all about Muni, and therefore Muni should pay for all of those calls. Well, there's no proof, of course, available, and fortunately, so far, no one has figured out how to measure who's doing the calling and why they're doing the calling. No one has kept those records, but that's an assumption that's being made. The same goes for some of their aspects, including how many lawyers you need to address the issues that people need. There's just so many things of that nature, and it's going to be fun as I, on a daily basis, observe the movement at City Hall as they attempt to deal with the issue involving the budget without losing the opportunity for election or reelection. And then finally, of course, up on us is the whole business of who will be the next governor of the state of California. There are a collection of people who are already running on the Democratic side of the aisle and on the Republican side of the aisle. On the Democratic side of the aisle, some people are still speculating that Dianne Feinstein may run. I say no. There's people who say Jerry Brown may run. I say yes. There's people who say Villaraigosa may run. I say maybe. There are people who say Newsom may run. Newsom says yes, he is running. There are people who says Wesley may run. There are people who say Jack O'Connell may run for governor. There were people who saying Garamendi was running. Well, Garamendi is suddenly running for Congress in the seat that's being abandoned by Ellen Tizer as she moves over to the State Department with Hillary Clinton. And who are the people that are helping to fund Garamendi's campaign? All the other candidates are helping to fund Garamendi's campaign to make sure that he enjoys a level of support that he otherwise for that job, so that he's not available for the other job. And so who do I think will win the race at this stage of the game? I'm frankly not prepared to make a hard prediction, but I would tell you that the name Brown resonates well in the state of California with lots of people that I know, and so there is a distinct possibility that that may be the reality, particularly if they confuse Jerry and Willie. It'll be to Jerry's detriment, I suspect. Nevertheless, there is race on the Democratic side of the aisle, and all the candidates are good, and I must tell you that no matter who they nominate on the Republican side of the aisle, I think the Democrat will win. On the other hand, the Republicans are looking at two or three possibilities. They're looking at Meg Whitman, who's down from, I think, Silicon Valley. She may have even banked with you on occasions. She has announced that she's going to spend $150 million running I have said to our collection of candidates, may I negotiate the settlement between you and Ms. Wegman? And they said, what will that be? I said, well, I'll say, if you're going to spend $150 million, give us $75 million, and we won't run. But she's talking about spending $150 million. That's an awesome amount of money. She could literally start and do wall-to-wall television for the remainder of the campaign from day one, and no one could match that. And in most political situations where you can't match the other side, particularly with reference to TV, the other side gets a golden opportunity. On the other hand, she's got a problem in the primary because as a young man who is the insurance commissioner, who will be a candidate in the primary, and he too has a ton of money. I mean, it's just no question Steve Posner has a ton of money, and he made it the same way she did in the Silicon Valley area in the good old days, and they left before the bottom fell out of their stock, and they took it with them. And so they're in pretty good shape, and the two of them appear to be the people who are in the contest for the nomination. Although there's a fellow, a professor, Tom Campbell, who was a state senator, who was a congressman, who was the head of the Department of Finance for a period of time, and is now, I think, over at the Goldman Institute in Berkeley. He is a candidate, and he is probably, in terms of ability and skill, the best qualified candidate. When you see them in person, when you see them paired up in the way in which they will be paired up for debate purposes, you will note the difference in the knowledge by virtue of experience and all the other things that Tom Campbell has versus his opponents. And then finally, the issue around the governor's race obviously will potentially be one of the different generations. Mr. Obama has elevated the level and appreciation of people who are newer and younger. And therefore, the whole business of Obama versus John McCain was a given. In those debates, Senator McCain had a disadvantage style-wise. He had a disadvantage height-wise. He had a disadvantage on a number of cases, and it was apparent that there was a dramatic generation gap. In the Democratic primary, Mr. Newsom is, I think, legitimately trying to demonstrate that there is a similar kind of gap. He wishes Jerry Brown to be viewed as John McCain, and he wishes himself to be viewed as Barack Obama. On the other hand, in conversation with Jerry Brown, he wishes to be viewed as Jerry Brown, and he wishes Newsom to be viewed as Sarah Palin. So there is a dramatic difference in the perception that respective candidates have. That, in sum and substance, gives you the perspective of how I view the current situation nationally, state, and locally. And I hope it has, in one manner or another, increased your level of interest. Keep reading the newspaper, and let the newspaper know you're reading them by subscribing. Because, believe me, the Internet cannot exist, just like television can't exist, without the foot soldiers. And the foot soldiers in the information delivery system or the reporters, neither of those two institutions rely upon their own reporters to supply them with information. Each of them reads the early morning paper and directs their stories almost right out of the content of some early morning paper. All across America, the newspapers are challenged because the advertisement has gone over to the Internet where they believe the people really are. I would hope that Commonwealth persons would understand the need for an independent, viable, talented, continuous group of journalists out there uncovering the information that will help us in this democracy make quality decisions. And to the extent you do for the Chronicle, I keep my column. Thank you.
Thank you, Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and Speaker of the Assembly, and a noted political commentator, for your comments this evening. I'm Joseph Fink, the president of Dominican University, just over the bridge in Marin County, and I'm the former chairperson of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'll be moderating the audience's question period this evening. Mayor Brown, there are a number of questions from both the about national, state, and local politics. So let me begin by asking one on the national level. During your comments, you seem to indicate that you were disappointed and saw some mistaken endeavors on the president's part in the appointment of his economic team. What are other mistakes do you believe that he's made in this early part of his administration?
I really don't think that there are any other places that I could go to where whatever the conduct has been, it's so inconsistent with the quality of all parts of his other service. So I wouldn't be able to answer that question. I don't know of any other glitches that has occurred in his delivery system. Obviously, there probably are some, but I don't know them. I've been so focused on Tim Geithner and Larry Sumner that I just can't get over the fact that those two guys are literally, in my opinion, they're going to create heartburn, ultimately, for the Obama administration.
Thank you. This next question comes from someone who is concerned over the fact that the president seemed to run from the left, but now is governing more from the center and is going to alienate the liberal aspects of the Democratic Party, and particularly the speaker from our own area, Nancy Pelosi. Do you believe that's correct?
No, I do not believe that that is correct. First and foremost, I think people have attributed, during the course of the campaign for the presidency, I think they attributed far more left-leaning interpretations to his utterances than he actually meant. There was clearly, all during the course of the campaign, Hillary was clearly to Obama's left on almost every issue of any substance. There were others in the on the contest who were equally to his left. Mr. Obama has been a centralist. He comes from a community organizing foundation and from a community operation unrelated to political parties, unrelated to the old traditional operations, in which I suspect is somewhat annoying to some people. On the left, he has frankly never, ever been a true leftist, so to speak. And so when the comment is that he's somehow angering the left, that is not true by any stretch of the imagination. And finally, he and Nancy Pelosi, I guarantee you, will always accommodate each other as he proceeds to have his administration set the agenda for the nation. Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker, may utter whatever word she wants to utter, but ultimately Barack Obama will call the tune.
Thank you. One of the areas where there does seem to be some disagreement is the fact that it has to do with the Speaker and other members of the liberal aspects of the Democratic Party. Let me paraphrase this as best I can. Supporting the investigation of possible criminal aspects of the Bush administration regarding torture and other parts of the pursuit of the so-called war on terror. Do you see that to be a conflict that's going to continue to occur?
No, I do not. It is not, frankly, the responsibility of the president, frankly, to make judgments about someone's conduct on the criminal side of the aisle. If there is any elected official who believes someone is engaged in criminal conduct, there are processes that can be employed to test the viability of that conclusion and of those assumptions. Mr. Obama's comments have afforded people the opportunity to do exactly that. That's why my response is there's absolutely no comment and no conflict. Mr. Obama is not going to comment on whether or not what John Conyers is talking about doing can and should be done. He will allow the process to visit itself. And frankly, in this democracy, that's the way it has to be. The justice system says you're entitled to assumption of innocence. You really are. You are presumed to be innocent until you're proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and to a moral certainty. I would hate to think that the president would stand up and announce, yeah, I think Willie Brown's a crook, and I think you ought to bust him for it. Well, that would obviously prejudice my opportunity for a fair trial, because most of you would listen closely and realize the appointment pending with the president for you will be determined by how you vote on my guilt or innocence. And as far as you're concerned, if you want that appointment, you're going to vote me guilty. It has nothing to do with the facts. And so Mr. Obama has taken the appropriate position that the executive ought to take, and that is this is not a matter that can't be addressed following the protocols and the rules that exist.
All right. There are a couple questions, and again, I'll try to summarize them. They're rather interesting. They're from individuals who are very supportive of the president, but they would have preferred that Hillary Clinton had been elected president. And they're asking whether or not she is being underutilized as the Secretary of State, number one. And number two, do you think she has a chance to still become the first woman president of the United States?
Well, first and foremost, I would tell you that this president, President Obama, is different from every previous president. Secretary Clinton's role is the role that I believe in this administration every secretary will play. There will not be anybody arising to the level of being perceived as the architect of the policy of this administration except the president himself. There will not be Don Rumsfeld. There will not be Ms. Rice. There will not be Colin Powell. There will not be Dick Cheney. There will not be any of those people in the Obama-type administration. And no person with those kind of credentials are going to upstage Barack Obama, period. So when you ask, is Hillary Clinton being underutilized? Yes, she's being underutilized if you're measuring by yesterday. No, she's not being underutilized if you're measured by the day. After all, while he was in Europe, he sent her off to Asia. He is now on his way to Asia. I don't know where he's going to send her, but she set the ground rules and literally did the advance work for his movement. When he has done the job that he needs to do, in whatever agreement he reaches, it will be her job to go back and do the finite details. That's the role of the Secretary of State, and that's the role that she will, in fact, play. Whether or not she'll ever be president, I would doubt seriously whether or not she'd be president, because I think Mr. Obama, the way in which he is currently operating, will not leave the presidency until he's about 57 years old. And I think Ms. Clinton will probably be in her 70s when he exits the door. If I recall her age correctly, she'll be near 70, and I don't think that that's reality. I do think, however, that she has to be seriously considered for that spot on the Supreme Court. I think Hillary Clinton on the Supreme Court, with the prospect of eventually becoming the Chief Justice, would be what this nation sorely needs.
Thank you very much. Let's switch to state politics now. It almost seems that since you left your role as a speaker that the legislature has become less and less effective. How would you react to that comment, and what specific actions would you note to make the legislature more effective in California?
Well, first and foremost, I think it is an accurate assessment that the legislature is less effective since 1995, when I last left that body. And they are less effective because of the quality of leadership that has succeeded all of us who were there for so many years, all of us who had developed great respect among the constituency for our leadership on particular issues, whether it was John Vasconcellos dealing with the issues of the budget, or whether it was some of the other titans in the various areas, whether it was Byron Scheer dealing with the issue involving the whole business of timber plans and timber placements, whether it was some of the other members whose name slips my memory at the moment. But in each one of those cases, there were really talented people who had over a multiple number of years developed a sense of what was to be done and how it should be done and where they could get the boats to do it. And they had developed the relationships with other people to gain those votes, whether they were Republicans or Democrats, thereby making the place far more effective. There was also the perception that the person who had the job of Speaker was a very powerful individual. And it's a very powerful individual because of all of the cumulative kinds of loyalty shown to that individual by people like Vasconcelos and others who followed that leadership. And therefore, that person was, in fact, able to exercise a degree of control and a degree of influence on the process and particularly on the policies that came out of the halls of the legislature and the whole business of dealing with a governor who was equally as experienced. Each of the previous governors, George Duke Machen, during my time, as well as Pete Wilson, had been state legislators. They had been state senators. They had been constitutional officers statewide. One had been a U.S. senator. And in each of those cases, their skills had been honed carefully. They understood that at the end of the day, it was not about partisan politics. It was about whether or not we could achieve a certain level of a policy that affected the lives of people. And then finally, we had a collective group of legislators who actually put public interest first. We understood how to arrive at that without offending our base constituents and those people who helped us. Currently, when you approach members of the legislature and wish to discuss some issue with them, invariably it will morph over to, well, you ought to check this out with CTA. You ought to check this out with the correction officers. You ought to check this out with some special interest organization. That obviously has an adverse effect on the ultimate product because, after all, special interest organizations do not necessarily have the public interest at the zenith of their thought processes. People who hold elective office must at all times extend the opportunity for anybody to discuss anything with them. But in the final hour and when the vote is cast, the guiding line and the guiding principle must be what ultimately is in the public's interest. That is apparently not the case. And it is not that any of these people of whom I speak are corrupt. It's not that any of these people are not talented. They all are. They just haven't had time long enough to establish a level of credibility and a level of independence that equips them to be effective decision makers in the halls of the legislature.
Thank you. To our radio listening audience, this is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco, a political commentator who is discussing the political arena in 2009. Mr. Mayor, you discussed the ballot propositions and the fact that you thought that they would probably or quite possibly fail and it would create some major difficulty for the state. What options, if they do fail, what options does the leadership of the legislature and the governor have?
They will be reduced in reality to reducing the size of government, eliminating programs only, simply because the two-thirds vote for any increase in revenues, that's the requirement. And there are not two-thirds of the people in the halls of the legislature prepared to so vote. And so the option is only going to be, what do we eliminate? And in this case, you can't just cut. You literally have to eliminate. I would guess that the first thing that's going to occur within the next month, if those measures do fail, I would guess there would be a wholesale release of nonviolent, sick, lame prisoners. We currently have 180,000 people under lock and key. You release 30,000 or 40,000 of those people, you're saving somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 to $40,000 per person. And in releasing them, you attach ankle bracelets and all the other things, and you thereby reduce the cost of the prison system. And you might have to do that whether the measure's passed or not, because there's a federal judge named Henderson who has ordered a level of care on the medical side that exceeds the capacity of the state to so finance. And so there has to be a give, and I would guess the first give is going to be the release of prisoners that probably ought not to be there anyway.
All right, well, that's certainly a sobering thought for those of us who are partaking in the election soon. Let me switch now, as time is decreasing, to some questions about the city. Presently, the city elections are held on a district level. Is it possible, do you believe, to get back to citywide elections for supervisors?
I don't think so. I think this town is fragmented with people whose special interest is in reducing the number of people that it takes to elect people to office. If you keep it down to the level where it is, you will always get the kind of board of supervisors you currently have. If you expand it to the totality of the city, then there cannot be the simple, narrow interests expressed by people in just little bitty enclaves or little bitty districts. There would have to be attention given to the west side, the east side, the north side, and the south side of the city if you had to run in the whole city. If you only have to deal with the west side, as is the case with Sean Ellsberg, if you only have to deal with the east side, as is the case with Mr. Daley and David Chu, if you only had to deal with the south side, as is the case with Sophie Maxwell, you can clearly see how you would know nothing about other parts of the city and get yourself elected and hold office. Those individuals and their constituencies, in many cases, will vote no for any change in the system. The system at one time was citywide. It became district, and then there was the assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk by a district supervisor. And instantly, the public abandoned district elections. And they stayed abandoned for almost 12, 15 years, maybe even 20 years, until the left got really clever. And they didn't put the question on, do you want district elections again, raw. They put on a series of ballot measures to say, in district elections, would you prefer lines A, lines B, or line C? And you obviously voted for whichever one of those lines you prefer without realizing you were voting to restore district elections. That's how clever those people really are and how clever they've been. And my guess is they would be equally as clever in a confrontation over whether or not there should still be districts. Just one of these days, there may be something that occurs so dramatically that we go back in this little bitty, incredible museum of a city of electing museum curators that care about every object that's in the museum.
Mr. Mayor, you've made a series of comments that we wish we had enough time to question or talk about, but unfortunately we've reached that point in the program where we have time for one last question. Before we get to that, though, I'd like to personally thank you for your willingness to speak with the Commonwealth Club every year on this annual basis about the political scene. Since we began this process 5 or 6 years ago, the crowds are getting larger and larger, and if we keep doing it for another 5 or 6 years, I expect we'll wind up in the Civic Center somewhere along the way. And we're especially grateful because we know you're a much sought-after speaker quite often with requests for speaking with honorariums in the 5 and 6 figures, and you do this on a pro bono basis, so we thank you very much for that. Now to that last question. When I first came to San Francisco and got to know you, I realized very quickly that I would need to spend more time at Wilkes Bashford, because not only were you one of the best assembly speaker we've ever had, and certainly probably one of the best mayors we've ever had, but you're certainly the best dressed mayor we've ever had. So the question, Mr. Mayor, is who in city politics is the worst dressed person?
To one extent or another, all of those currently holding public office are bad dressers.
Oh, dear. Our thanks to Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco, and our noted political commentator. We also wish to thank our audiences here and on the radio and television and the Internet. I'm Joseph Fink, the president of Dominican University, and it is now time for this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, to be adjourned.